This is the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. It is our great pleasure, Bill Russell's and mine, to be with Dr. John Hope Franklin, twice a pleasure, because we are at the New Schools of Carver in Atlanta, Georgia. You are an American historian, and it is very important for me to make the distinction that you have looked for 75 years at America and understand the experience of African Americans in that context, that you are not what it would be called an African American historian, although you are African American. This notion that you cannot understand America without understanding the black experience seems to me to be absolutely core to all these things we're talking about, and that this 300 years when the rhetoric was wonderful and the reality was not, that as an American historian, that you have a great deal to tell us about where we might focus our attention into that place where race wouldn't be what it has always been in America.
From the time that the first Africans came to this country in 1619, they were regarded as different, and the talk and the writing and the legislation was for the purpose of underscoring their difference. They were inferior mentally, they were inferior physically, they were inferior emotionally.
That was the contention.
That was the argument. That was the argument that was handed down by those who wanted to justify the fact that slaves, that Africans were used as slaves. You use them as slaves because they are inferior. You use them as slaves because they didn't smell right. You use them as slaves because they didn't act right. Or they couldn't count, or they couldn't do this or the other. They had to have close supervision. And there was built up a great body of thought about them to justify their lowly status.
And their exploitation.
And that has to be remembered. And there was no one that said, oh, you're wrong. There's no one that said, oh, you're wrong. They're this, they're that, and the other. So the fact that there was almost unanimous agreement that these people should be treated this way sets up a code of conduct and a system that persists right down through slavery, through the end of slavery. Now, if you've done this all 200 or 300 years, if you set up these arguments, if you defended what you're doing, then a war can't change it overnight. A set of amendments can't change it overnight. Oh, you can write the 13th Amendment, which sets them free. But the 14th Amendment, which gave them all their rights, that's some question about that. There's some question about that. For if you believe, as you and I may believe, that they are entitled to their rights, at the same time, a vast number of others who don't think they have any rights and who won't give them their rights, and there's no one that will say to others that you should give them their rights. And so they suffer just the same. And that's what's happened all during American history from the beginning down to 2005. We've had these increments of change, and I don't decry or criticize them. I simply say that the change was never enough to bring about real and true equality.
One of the things that I find really interesting thinking about history is how many things I don't know. And there's a brand new biography out about John Brown, who is white and says to his family and his friends, and over the course of 20 or 30 years, that he believes what the Declaration of Independence says and what the Constitution says. He really believes it. So once in a while, you'll have somebody who, it's that grain of sand, who truly believes that which we might be and acts upon it. Now, then he gets villainized, and this villainization, if that's a word. There is this tussle of there are people who are willing to stand up, and it comes at a cost. John Brown,
he's vilified, and he is degraded, and he's an activist who undertook to set the slaves free, and they said, oh, that's a no-no. And it won for him a hanging. That's what it won for him.
And he was really fine with that.
Yes, yes.
He went to that gallows understanding that he had made a difference.
Yes.
Isn't that part of what Bill was saying early on, that there is courage in this? You don't necessarily have to hang, but you must put yourself in a place where doing the right thing is important.
Yes, yes.
It's also, in that context, it's also a tribute to the power of words. My understanding is that Emerson particularly, but lots of other people
that
as
would
well,
be Ralph Waldo,
Ralph Waldo Emerson, and John Brown himself, and the way he conducted himself from the time he was arrested to the time he was executed, that their ability to articulate what mattered and why they had done what they did was a substantial force in moving the world, the country to civil war, but that also the words themselves made a difference in the history of this country.
Right, right. Surely John Brown's words made a difference. Ralph Waldo Emerson's words made a difference. But we have to watch the words, because the deeds must follow the words. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. That sounds good. Those words were written by a slaveholder who didn't believe in equality, who didn't treat his slaves as his equals, and who went to his own grave without having set his slaves free.
Including his own children.
Yes, I speak of Thomas Jefferson, of course. So that words are important, but it takes action to back up those words to make them really powerful. And that's where we get some difference. You can speak the speech, but if you don't act on the basis of the speech, then you're left with a void.
One of the things that's so exciting about your very exciting life, exciting and historian isn't always put together, but you have had an exciting life, is the fact that President Clinton tapped you to lead a new conversation in America about race. I suspect that you did not anticipate what that was going to be when he invited you to do that. One of the things I found so interesting in that process, well, two things I'd really like to talk about. One is that you set forth early on that we needed to envision being beyond race, and we couldn't get there if we didn't explore it carefully and talk about it and endure the discomfort, the pain, the queasiness some people feel. That if we didn't say, look, 300 years of slavery has made a difference, we are not there yet, we are out in the world at large, and you talk about all of these wars where Americans went off to die and kill for freedom for other countries when it wasn't happening at home and it didn't win the African Americans' freedom at home. Unless we are talking about this, we will be unable to do the next thing, and this is the do, which is, tell me what this country would look like if we didn't always have race on the table.
Yes, in 1997, when the President of the United States asked me to chair the advisory board, which he hoped would begin a conversation out of which would come a better understanding, out of which would come some specific guidelines and steps to move toward real racial equality. When he asked me to chair that group, only seven people in the group, including me, I thought that was a great challenge. And I thought that perhaps this country was ready to begin and carry forward a dialogue about race that would bring us to a determination to do something specific and concrete and long-lasting about the whole question of race. I learned a great deal in those 18 months that I chaired that board. I learned how far we were from solving the problem. I learned how far we were from being even willing to face the problem head on and to try to do something about it. I learned, for example, that there were those who felt that you couldn't do anything about race. Just give it up. Just forget it. I learned that there were those who felt that we'd already done enough and the problem had been solved. And I learned that there were those who, for their own special personal reasons, didn't want to do anything about it because they had their own agendas, which might be different from those of full equality.
And all of those could be found in every color.
That's right. That's right. All of those could be found in every color. And that made it very difficult for us to move forward and to even to explore and to carry on an honest dialogue about it. And it meant that there were those who criticized us for no good reason. It meant that we did not have the means to communicate. I want everyone to know that if you don't have a radio and television and newspaper and other things that communicate, if you don't have that, you can't get the word out. You cannot get the word out. And so there we were, sort of boxed in. We didn't have a newspaper. We had to go through other newspapers, other radio stations, other television stations, and they took what they wanted. And frequently they took nothing. And I have, for example, large numbers of people today who say, "Did you make a report?" Well, we made a report almost as thick as my autobiography, telling of all the things we did, but people don't know it. People don't know it. One of the best lessons that you can learn from studying the report of the President's Advisory Board on Race is that you can keep things away from the American public if you want to, and if you have the means to do it.
This is Dr. John Hope Franklin, and I suspect that Bill Russell will want to talk about the media when we come back in a moment with the Paula Gordon Show. Be with us when we return with Dr. John Hope Franklin, one of our most esteemed Americans and certainly historians.